Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's pretty decent out there this morning, although it's going to rain a little bit later. So no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Good conversation, wet or dry, always here on 94 WIP. And when we come back in just a bit, author Timothy J. Smith, his new book, The Fourth Courier, a novel. It's a novel. It's not too early to start thinking about what you're going to read as the weather changes and maybe start thinking about what to take on vacation. So, vacation, maybe a trip to Poland, which is where the novel is set, and a whole lot more coming back here on 94 WIP in just a bit. The WIP time, 6:02. And we're back. It's Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. I want to say good morning to Timothy Smith, author of the new book.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. The Fourth Courier, a novel. Timothy, why'd you set the novel in 1992 Poland?
Why did I set the novel there in 1992? That was a period of tremendous transformation in Poland. It was right at the time where communism had fallen throughout Eastern Europe, and they had moved to a market economy. Poland was the lead country in doing that, and the book opens about 4 months after the actual collapse of the Soviet Union, and which put Russia right on its eastern border. And there was a lot of fear at that time that there would be nuclear material smuggled out of Russia through Poland to somewhere else in the world. And that's the basic premise of the story.
What was the genesis of the story, though? Where did it come from?
Well, I was living in Poland at the time. I actually was an advisor to the new Solidarity government on some financial issues. I was there to help introduce a mortgage finance system to the country for the first time in its history. But as part of that period, I was doing short-term assignments throughout Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And I was in Latvia at one point, which had received its independence from the Soviet Union. And I was meeting with a Russian general who was very unhappy about the situation. It was a formal meeting. And when that ended, he said, let's go out someplace where nobody can hear us. And he walked me out into the middle of a forest. I had no idea what he wanted to talk about or what was happening. And basically he turned to me and said, I can get you anything you want. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, atomic. And we just had a discussion about the nuclear arsenal that might possibly be in Latvia. And he clearly misunderstood why I was there. But I was a little bit surprised at what he seemed to be offering me. So later when I sat down to decide to write a book about that period, I decided to take the story from that moment.
Certainly a frightening overture the general made.
Yeah. I couldn't tell how real it was, but I think it was intended to be a real offer. It was just a time where, you know, people had no idea why Americans were even there. It was the changes were so profound and so fast that the whole thing was collapsing for everybody, basically.
It must have been an exciting time, but at the same time, a scary time. The general could have been trying to set you up for being arrested.
You know, I never thought about that. It just seemed so unreal. I just basically said, sorry, you just don't understand why I'm here, and turned around and walked away. But yeah, I suppose it could have been set up to be arrested. It was a very disconcerting time for everybody, but it was exciting at the same time. I was working with the new Solidarity government. Solidarity had been elected in the first free Polish elections since the very early 1900s, and that was in 1989. That's what really started the fall of communism. It's 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. I've set the book to be a couple of years later because of plotting purposes, because it also picks up on the war in Serbia. So I had to place a couple of years later. But just to point out to people, this year is the 30th anniversary of the fall of communism in Eastern Europe and the fall of the Berlin Wall.
30 years ago to the setting of the book, but at the same time, the book feels like it could have been ripped right out of today's headlines.
Yeah, I know. That's what's sort of surprising about today's headlines. It's still the Cold War. I mean, it's just moved to our ballot boxes and places like that.
So we shouldn't feel any secure, should we?
I think what's happening is that Russia is trying to reassert itself as a really great power in the world, and it like the British, who have lost their empire and have regretted that for a long time, and that's partly what's behind Brexit. What's going on with Russia now and Putin is, again, looking back at the good old days when they were in power or were equally in power, and they're trying to regain that to an extent. And I don't think there's ever been a time where there wasn't a competitiveness going on in very stark terms between America and Russia, just that now we're a little more aware of it because of what kind of meddling has been going on in our own country.
Okay. Poland. Is Poland better off since then?
Is Poland better off?
Mm-hmm.
Poland's much better off. It really was the rising star of a modern Western-style economy right after the communists sort of lost the situation. For two or three decades, it was doing very, very well. It's going through its own turbulent political time right now. It's sort of jerked itself back to the right, and there are some of the gains that were democratic gains, basically, in the country, in the court system that worked, and the kind of things that we respect in our country and why our democracy works, those are beginning to be chipped away at in Poland again. So it's a troubling time for Poland right now.
You think that's because the communists are regaining power or influence?
No, I don't. No, it's really, the communists are always considered really very far left on the political spectrum. And what we see in Poland today, and I'm not a great expert at this, but what we see in Poland today is a big swing to the right. It's really moving more towards a fascistic state, if I can use that word, and I don't really like to use that word, than it is to a communist state. It's a very much a situation where power is being increasingly controlled centrally and taking power from the people. So the court system in particular has been really badly damaged in Poland.
Now, the reason I ask is sometimes you can go far to the left, you hit the right, or the right to hit the left.
I guess that's right, yeah.
All right. Briefly, names and dates changed to protect the guilty and the innocent. What's the plot of The Fourth Courier?
The plot of The Fourth Courier is that it opens with knowing that there have been three grisly murders in Warsaw, all done in the same way, and on the hands of the third victim, and it's been over about 3 months that this has happened, in the hands of the third victim, they discover traces of radiation. So the fear is that because all these guys were murdered in the same way, they might have all been smugglers of nuclear material out of Russia. And that raises an international cry of alarm because, of course, that means somebody is trying to put together enough nuclear material to either have a lot of dirty bombs or one big bomb or something like that. And the Solidarity government, which had never had any experience in these kinds of investigations, basically says, we need help. And the FBI sends in a special agent to help in the investigation. A lot of people don't realize that, a lot of Americans don't realize that the FBI actually works all over the world. And in any country where there are problems with terrorism, human trafficking, major drug smuggling, there's an FBI agent there to help investigate the crimes. They don't do espionage. They're not spies, but they are criminal investigators. And in The Fourth Courier, what happens is that the story has both elements of crime, because there are these murders that nobody knows who's done, and possibly espionage and smuggling of nuclear material. And so in the book, a CIA agent and an FBI agent team up to basically solve the case.
Sounds like a very male book, you know, spies, murder. Any ladies running around the book?
Yeah, there are. And in fact, my style of writing is that I take an event or a threat, what is basically a thriller plot, but I use it to show what it really means, what the events really mean to ordinary people. So in this case, the FBI agent has an affair with a woman and becomes very familiar with her family. There is a connection back to the actual case involved. But it's through those interactions that the reader begins to see what life was really like for Polish people at that time. And the principal antagonist in the book is a female, actually, too. So you get kind of both sides. And one thing people like about the book is that in a lot of thrillers or murder mysteries or things, you basically just see the story from the good guy's perspective. But I go behind the scenes and kind of show both perspectives. So you go between characters and sort of understand through both sides of what that whole period of time meant for people. There's a lot that women have enjoyed about this particular book. And I use that style in my other writing as well, where I take either a terrorist event in the Middle East or a human trafficking problem in Africa or something, and I take what is a thriller plot, but I use it to basically tell a story about the people that are engaged in it.
For a thriller to be successful in a lot of times in America, got to have a car chase, got to have a lot of blood, and got to have some naked people. You have those three?
Yeah, I do have those three. One commentator said was that I write so freely about both gay and heterosexual relationships in the book that the readers will love it because it's sort of natural, and that's how I wanted it to be. And so there's sex, there's naked people. There is sort of a car chase, not like you see on TV. It's kind of an older car. It doesn't work very well. And there's a little bit of blood. It's not a very violent book, to be honest. It's more of a psychological book.
Why do you think we like these books? I mean, you could have written something else. Why the thriller, espionage, murder kind of book?
I write the kind of books that I like to read. And I like to read books that have a good, strong plot and a fair amount of action and kind of, are reasonably fast-paced. I mean, in the past, I've read, lots of classical literature and all sorts of things that are long and beautifully crafted, but a little bit tedious to me now. And I like to have a book that's a little bit faster-paced. But I'm driven also by wanting to inform readers, expose them to things they don't know about, perhaps, like human trafficking. A lot of people really don't have a real sense of what that means to people in the world. And so I wrote a book that was about that. So I use these fast-paced books, but to illuminate certain issues, usually it's one issue per book, that are of critical concern to the world. I did the same thing when about 15 years ago I established a national playwriting prize called the Smith Prize for Political Theater. And the idea is take a big picture story on immigration or racism or genetic engineering, but make it intimate. Show what that means through the lives of a person or a family. And I do the same thing in all my books.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Timothy Smith, author of the new novel, The Fourth Courier. Timothy, is there anything in this for women?
Well, there is I don't want to give too much away, but the woman that the FBI agent gets involved with is a big character in the book, and she really is based on somebody I knew who was in a very difficult situation. I mean, if you can imagine that, here was a woman who was divorced from a violent man, but had to stay in the same tiny apartment because there was no housing to be found. And so she's really the one who helps convey the story of what it was really like for the families and the people in Poland at that time, the kind of how the whole situation, they were all sort of trapped. They were hopeful that things would change, but they were still bogged down, the system that left them very little room to maneuver, left no room for ambition. There was just very little chance for mobility in any way. So, yes, I wrote this book. I know it sounds very male-driven, but I wrote this book to clearly having a couple of female characters in mind. And the antagonist in this book, which is a female, is a very complex character as well, and sort of really shows how women had to, what they had to do to survive a system, the communist system, which is also very male-dominated. So I think women will find this book interesting. The advanced reviews for women have been terrific. They love it.
What was it like in 1992 Poland? I mean, small apartment, crowded apartment, lots of cabbage tea?
I didn't quite catch all that, but what it was like, it was tough. There was very little available. There was still, by 1992, things had improved a little bit more, but I was there from 1990, beginning of 1990 to the end of 1992. And I saw a fair amount of change in that time, but I remember in the winter of 1990, and I'm talking about the winter of 1991, going into a market and all they had were oranges and sauerkraut. There's absolutely nothing else to be purchased. It was very tough finding food, and certainly any variety of food was unheard of. When shops opened, like I remember one little French cheese shop opened like 6 or 9 months into my tour of duty there. And it was such a big deal that you could suddenly get, you know, real cheese, that kind of stuff. It was hard for people. People were losing their jobs. A lot of industries were very inefficient. Communism didn't die or didn't go away because of political or military power or threats or whatever. It died because of its inefficiency. You can't imagine quite how inefficient it was. And I remember one time I was on a fairly senior mission going into Russia itself. And, you know, we're thinking Russia is a real threat to us with nuclear weapons and high technology and stuff. And this guy he was the deputy minister of something. And this guy had five telephones lined up on his desk. He had five telephone lines. He had five telephones. And when the phone rang, it was like out of a Groucho Marx movie. He would be picking up every receiver going, hello, 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 until he figured out which line was really ringing. So it was... It was an unusual place to be at that time, and there were a lot of inefficiencies, which made it very hard for people.
As a writer, which is more important to you, a good review or a good royalty check?
A good review or a good what?
Or a good royalty check.
Oh, well, since I've rarely had a good royalty check, I'll say a good review.
Why?
It's just satisfying that I connect with people and to know that either they really like the way I've crafted a book or they like my particular style of writing. I spend a lot of time. I don't sit at my desk hours of the day and 3 hours on or 3 years on a novel thinking about the royalty check. I really think about, I hope people will like this book and will understand what I'm trying to do here. And will like my style, which is very spare. I don't do a lot of descriptions, but what people love is that I give them just enough that they feel they're immediately in that place. I tend to write in a sense of scenes in my head. I grew up, you know, with the television around all the time, and I had a sense of scenes, and I do screenwriting. And so people really like that because it tends to move the book along. And they see things very well. What I really get back from people, what they say about all my novels is the sense of authenticity. And that's because I only write about places where I've spent a couple of years or I've done a lot of work or are very familiar with. So, and they, in the Fourth Courier in particular, they say the way that one image or that one little conversation just tells us so much about the place that we're right there.
What's next?
In terms of writing,
yes.
I I'm very, very, very close to finishing a novel set in Greece. I know Greece very well. I've been going there for 40 years. My first job after university was set in Greece, and this is sort of my homage to Greece. It's a fairly lighthearted book. It very much draws on characters and places that I know. That's basically, I'm in the last edits of that. And I've already started another novel, which will be set in Istanbul. It's a story of a Syrian refugee in Istanbul who is recruited by the CIA to go very deep into ISIS and to try to stop a particular event. So, and I'm well into that. So I've got two projects that are I'm working on at the same time. I think that the Greek book will probably be out by the end of next year, be published.
Now, as a writer, I'm sure you write for a worldwide audience, but with a large piece of your audience hopefully being here in America, is it easier or harder to write with all the time you spend in Europe? I mean, you're talking to us now from France.
Right. I've not yet written a book set in America. I have a book in mind. I've got a story in mind, and I thought it was going to be the next thing I was going to work on, but the situation in America right now is so troubling to me that I just didn't want to take it on. I felt that I would be writing from a place of disappointment and anger about what's going on in the States, and that's not the story I want to tell, because I am a 16th generation American, and I've always really respected my history and my family history, and you know, I've got relatives we know were fighting in the Revolutionary War and stuff like that. So I didn't want to write a book that I was looking at contemporary America through eyes that just weren't the eyes I wanted to see it. I had to put that aside. But I write for a worldwide audience, but particularly Americans, because that's where I'm from and that's where my agent is, and that's where I have a lot of connections.
And as we close the book, The Fourth Courier, after we finished it, what do you want us to think?
What I want people to take away from it is being sensitized to the kind of struggles that average people go through in different situations, and this was a particularly interesting one, how they respond to changes that are totally out of their control and yet are really influencing their lives. And I want them to go away liking the characters.
Well, the changes out of their control seems to be an interesting parallel to today.
I think there are a lot of parallels to today. I think there are a lot of parallels today, yes.
And I'd like to say thank you to Timothy Smith, author of The Fourth Courier, worth looking at on a spring evening or this summer as you're packing for vacation. Thank you, Timothy.
My dream is to walk down the beach and see somebody reading my book. So I hope they take it on the beach.
From your lips to God's ears. Thank you, Timothy Smith.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bye.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be back after these messages. We're back. The conversation continues here on 94WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. I'm pleased to welcome back a friend. He's been on before, and he'll probably be on again. Stephen David Elliott comes to us. Well, we'll find out what he comes to us to bringing. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you? I had a cup of coffee, so I'm feeling very prepared for today.
Good. Now, I have to say something to start with, Stephen. You're Chief Visionary Officer of Rockstar Connect. You're National Director of Business Development for Fathom Realty. And you're a serial entrepreneur. Your resume makes me tired, let alone your life. How do you do it?
Well, I don't know whether it's a question of how you do it. I'm driven to do it. Several times in my life, I've worked for myself since I'm 21 years of age. I've started and sold businesses. There have been many times where I didn't have to work at all, and because I am driven to create, I start again. As soon as I think, hey, I'm not going to do it anymore, I have to do it again because I enjoy creating. And everything that's associated with that, helping other people, helping people create their careers, keeping my mind stimulated. It's just the way I'm driven, and I feel that a lot of the people out there listening that are entrepreneurs feel the same way.
What makes an entrepreneur an entrepreneur?
Well, what makes an entrepreneur, I think you're born an entrepreneur. There are many people out there that say they would like to be an entrepreneur. And when you really delve into what their drive is, it's essentially they just want to do better than what they're doing. They're unhappy with their job. They're unhappy with the way their life is going in their career. But a true entrepreneur, for me, is someone that despite whatever obstacles might be put in their way, they want to create something that is their own, that they have control of, that may not have existed before. That would be an entrepreneur to me.
So you think you were born that way, wasn't created by your parents or some other outside influence?
Well, I did have certainly, I was inspired by other people in my life as I was growing up as a child. I don't think they created me. They were just the people that I wanted to emulate, people that were leading the type of lives that I wanted to live as an entrepreneur.
Okay. Rockstar Connect, tell me about it.
Well, Rockstar Connect, this is an interesting entrepreneurial endeavor that demonstrates what we're talking about exactly. I was doing what I thought was going to be the last thing I did in my life. I owned bookstores, and I enjoyed it. It required as much or as little time as I wanted. I got to interact with very exciting and intelligent people in the rare book business. I had several stores, and they were extremely successful. And Peter, in the age of online books and Amazon, I guess everyone said the book business was dead, but I was doing extremely well in it. And that was a big question. People would come to me and they said, "We love what you're doing. You're able to make money doing this. How are you able to do that?" And I reflected on how my company was successful. And I recognized that instead of promoting my core business, which were the bookstores that had coffee shops and rare books and were very fun and exciting to go to, I didn't promote that core business. What I did is I did things for the community in order to satisfy the community's wants and needs. So I had book signings, and I had a farmer's market, and I had networking events, and all sorts of things that the benefit of the community, and they would reward me for what I did well by coming and shopping in my business. And I said, what are those things that I do in my business that can be duplicated? I said, well, not everybody's going to do a farmer's market, right, Peter? That's a lot logistically.
Right.
Not everyone's going to do a music series. But I think everyone could benefit from networking. From growing their sphere of influence, by interacting with other local businesses, helping them, and then being rewarded with material and spiritual abundance. So I went and I sold my bookstores and decided to develop this new part of my life. I thought I was done doing what I was going to do, but I said, this is something new. I have to try it. I'm driven now to do it. And I became a real estate agent and had my own networking event. And utilizing that networking event, I became the number one agent in my brokerage of over 1,000 real estate agents. I said, this is terrific. It worked exactly the way I thought it would, doing this regular event that benefited the community. How can I scale that? That's something that a lot of entrepreneurs want to do. They want to do something bigger than themselves. Not just like they're one-off. They want to do it to help as many people as possible and have great impact. So I created a course on what I was doing, and many people took the course, and they enjoyed the course, and the response was, this is a very comprehensive course. But that being said, I can't do what you do. It takes a lot of moving parts to do a consistent networking event. I don't have the staff to do that. I can't train people to do it. I don't know how to do it. And that was the eureka moment. I said, now I know how to monetize my idea. I will do that function for my clients. So essentially the clients of Rockstar Connect, they are rock stars. They are successful people. They're successful real estate agents, attorneys, financial advisors, authors, speakers, and they want to grow their local network. They want to have local notoriety. They want to help people in their community. And of course, they want to grow awareness of their business. The people that come to the event, the attendees, are the audience for the rock star. They are the brand evangelists for the host of these networking events. They consume the social media that Rockstar Connect creates associated with the event, and they go to the events that, the venues that we secure for the host. Rockstar Connect, we're simply roadies for the rock star. We're doing all the heavy lifting, all the logistics for the event, booking the event, database management, follow-up, everything associated with the event. And because of what I've done as an entrepreneur to create this company with my partners and with the employees of the company, and of course with our fantastic Rockstar Connect hosts around the country, we've created the largest business networking event company in the world. We do over 155 events per month, and we've had hundreds of thousands of attendees since we've started. Despite the financial, in addition to the financial success, for me, it's just creating something that impacts people all around the United States and Canada every single day in a positive way. And I think that's the ultimate entrepreneur payoff for me.
Now, your title with Rockstar Connect is Chief Visionary Officer. What are you visionarying? I like that title.
Yeah, isn't that a great title? And I would love to claim that I created that title, but it is something out there in the C titles. We're talking CEO, CEO, CFO. A CVO is someone that works with the CEO to determine the vision of a company. So Rockstar Connect, of course, was my idea. It was my vision, but it's certainly not something that one person can do on their own. So I have a fantastic team. I have a CEO. I have a vice president of operations. I have a vice president of business development. We can go on and on and on, the people that are required to make my vision go forward. And so the company runs separate from the visionary officer. It has its day-to-day. It's run by the CEO. And the CEO consults with me to determine what products are we bringing to market, what value can we bring to our clients, what is the next step in Rockstar Connect's growth.
It's almost research and planning.
Research and planning, and it almost has a spiritual element to it. I'll wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I woke up before this call, and I was jotting down notes of things that just struck me that people need. And we've discussed this before. My background, it was initially as a social worker, and what social workers do is, we determine what people's needs are, and then we find the ways to fulfill them. And to a certain respect, as a chief visionary officer, that's my role for the company. What do our rock stars need? What do the attendees of the events need? And how? What ideas do I have that my team can implement to satisfy those needs?
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Stephen David Elliott, Chief Visionary Officer, Rockstar Connect, National Director of Business Development for Fathom Realty, and a multi-level serial entrepreneur. And we're talking about the whole notion of networking and why it's critical. My name's Peter Solomon. All right. But what you do takes money. Takes money to hire you, if nothing else.
Yes, I mean, it certainly takes money to build a national and international company. Absolutely. You cannot be undercapitalized when you're attempting to build something very big and large.
Well, but it takes money just to hire you to do one networking event, doesn't it?
Oh, as a company?
Yeah.
Actually, we see ourselves in partnership with our host. As I told you, I'm the visionary officer for the company. We're trying to be a disruptor. We want to be doing every type of networking event that's possible, whether that be our typical evening events or whether that be, you know, a webinar online or a seminar or a summit or conference in person. And our hosts help us create that brand visibility throughout the world so that we have the ability to carry these, you know, lofty goals off. Our hosts, they pay us a small fee every month for us to facilitate their events and make them run seamlessly to the outside observer. So I would have to say, yes, it does cost money. It's not a program for everyone. It's for people that are already successful, that are already rock stars, that want to add or add the tool of networking to their business, or they more efficiently want to network. So they're willing to pay the fee that we charge in order to have their own Rockstar Connect program.
Did you ever give an event, do everything right, and nobody came?
It's rare. I mean, have we ever had an event where nobody came? That's never happened. That's absolutely never happened. Have we had events where less people have attended than we expected? It happens. It happens infrequently. With the systems that we utilize and working with our hosts to teach them how to utilize their social media and how to work their existing sphere of influence, we have a very high level of success of getting people to events, getting the proverbial tuchuses into seats.
Is that how you measure events, though, and measure success? How many people are sitting down at the given event?
Absolutely not. First of all, we don't want them sitting down at the event. We want them we want them mingling with one another. We want them making meaningful connections. You can have an event with 10 people at the event that may be far more successful than an event with 100 people. And alternatively, some people work better with a smaller group, and other people work better leading a larger group. So definitely attendance is not the sole purpose of an event, nor is that what our company is guaranteeing. What we do in our company is we've identified that it takes people to run a consistent networking event as a host at least 40 hours a month in order to continually do their event and do the follow-up that's necessary to make the event successful. Rockstar Connect does that for their clients, for the hosts of the events. That's what we do.
What kind of follow-up is required?
Well, just as simple as, okay, first of all, prior to the event, you booked an event, you booked it with a venue like a restaurant or a bar. Those places can be a little bit chaotic. You know, just because you think you're on the calendar doesn't mean you're on the calendar. A busy person can't do that follow-up. We regularly reach out to the venue to make certain that everything will go smoothly the night of the event, that everything is prepared, that they have enough staff on hand. Our company does that. We're also answering all the questions from the attendees regarding the events, whether that comes through social media, emails, or phone calls. The night of the event, we're the hotline. If there's any issues with the event, we're taking care of those issues for the client. So they can continue doing their core responsibility, which is networking, helping their attendees, and also growing their own business. Then after the event, someone has to thank the venue and follow up with the venue and see if it was successful for the venue, whether they want to continue with the event, or can there be anything done to refine how the event was delivered to make it a better experience for the people next time. also the attendees at the event. They're delivering all their, you know, their business cards. They're filling out sign-in sheets. Our company transcribes and scans all those business cards, provides it back to the host so they can do follow-up. And on our end, we maintain email databases, so we thank the attendees for attending the event, and then we're inviting them to the next event and encouraging them to share the information about the event with other people that they know in their network. Because we're about making, you know, connecting rock stars all over the world. So there's a lot of follow-up required, and most people, if they were going to do an event on their own, they would never be able to do it at the level that we're doing it. If they did, it would almost become their full-time job.
Or be able to think of the step that you guys think of to make the event a
success. Well, there's so many steps. For example, we post the event for the client. And that seems like a very simple thing. You know, Peter's going to go online and he's going to post an event. Well, we have determined there's 180 tasks that need to be done just to properly post an event on social media on the different platforms. That step alone takes 6 hours to do for a company like ours that knows what we're doing. For an individual, they may not even know what they're doing, and it could take them far more than 6 hours to post their event. Believe me, if it's taking them less than that, they're not doing it properly, and they're not going to be able to reach the audience at the level that they're trying to achieve.
Social media is really making a difference in your business, isn't it?
Social media is an excellent tool. It's a digital tool. Networking in general has always required tools. Telephones, for example, you know, you need to jump on a telephone to follow up with someone or to reach out with them. Of course, you and I are probably of a similar generation where there was such a thing as a Rolodex, where we had all the information put into a little file where we can find people's names quickly. Now we use a CRM or a database or some sort of way to follow up with our attendees. Social media is important because there's only going to be a certain amount of people that go to any particular event, and that's fantastic. Those are great people that you can interact with belly to belly. But if you use social media properly, thousands of people can know that you have an event. And part of the reason of hosting a networking event versus just being an attendee is trying to let people know about your belief systems, letting them know that you care about the local community, that you're willing to pay it back. That way more people can know who you are, they can like you and trust you, and then they could potentially refer business to you.
Now,
social media allows you to leverage that at a much higher level. So maybe only 10 people came to your event, but 10,000 people knew you had an event. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Now, you talk about it being good for the community and paying the community back. How does an event do that?
Well, the people that are going to the events, people say, well, I know why the host is doing the event. At first, they don't know why the host is doing the event, but after I explain it, they know why the host is doing the event. They go, why do the attendees go to the event? The attendees, you know, ostensibly, they're going to the event in order to grow their own business. They want to have more success in their business. They want to meet more people. They want to grow their sphere. That's one of their pain points. It's hard to do that from your home, and a lot of people that go to these events are small business owners, they're entrepreneurs. They don't interact with a lot of people. They may be working from home, they may be working in office, so it's great to get out and meet other entrepreneurs. But it's more than that. It's about the meaningful connections they make with people that can help their business, that can mentor them, or people that they can mentor. They can find employees for their company. And, of course, you know, at these events, at Rockstar Connect events around the country, people are passing millions of dollars of referrals amongst each other every single year. And that has a big impact on the local business community.
So the benefit to the community is really an economic one.
It's an economic one, and it's also a matter of fellowship. I feel that one of the great things about social media is it connected so many people. On the other hand, though, it's isolated so many people because they've almost become they're phobic about going out into public. They don't interact with a lot of people except online. This is their opportunity to become more human and have that human touch and meet other people that are in a similar situation to their own. They can celebrate together. They can commiserate with one another. They can share success and they can share failure to the whole group's advantage.
Now, if anybody listening this morning wants more information about Rockstar Connect, giving an event, networking, what do you want them to do?
Well, I mean, the best thing for them to do would be go to our website, rockstarconnect.com. There's quite a bit of information about the program, and it also gives you the ability to contact us to learn more. We also have a Facebook page, Rockstar Connect, where you can see photos of a lot of our events, and you can see, you know, more meet other people that go to the events around the country. We're always available. We have Rockstar Connect success coaches that will get on the phone and speak with them. But also, a lot of times, I like to take the call and jump on the phone and hear people's thoughts about, you know, the way their life is going as an entrepreneur and also how they may want to participate in Rockstar Connect, either as a host or as an attendee. So that's rockstarconnect.com.
And I'd like to say thank you to Stephen Elliott, Chief Visionary Officer of Rockstar Connect, for joining us here this morning on Conversations. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. Terrific speaking with you, Peter.
My pleasure. And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. The sun is coming up. It's going to be a decent morning. But this afternoon, you're threatening rain. So take an umbrella with you just in case. And no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Always good conversation. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Todd Solomon, my associate producer. Couldn't do the shows without you. Nothing left to say, but see you soon. And the conversation continues here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday. WIP Sunday, my name's Peter Solomon. We've got a little theme going here this morning. The theme of success in the workplace and in life. And when we come back just a bit, we're going to be talking with author Lydia Finette. Her new book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You. Power, women, and a whole lot more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday, and we're spending our Sunday morning with author Lydia Finette. Her new book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You. Good morning, Lydia Finette.
Great to be with you this morning.
Good. Lydia, if a woman's powerful and a man's powerful, we look at them very differently, don't we?
Yes, I think that that's definitely the case.
While times are changing, a man's supposed to be powerful. It's his job out there in the workplace, and he should go out and get what he needs and wants. If a woman's powerful in the workplace, she's the B word. You think that's still true?
You know, I wrote the book because I felt like women in this day and age have not had a chance to have a voice in the way that we've always wanted to. And by writing this book, I was really trying to show women that their power is within themselves. So it really doesn't matter what other people think about them, which I think is really what we've been taught our entire lives. We're fearful that people aren't going to like us. We're fearful that we're going to say the wrong thing or that people are going to think that we're trying to promote ourselves. And so when I sat down to write this book, my message was more about finding power within yourself and worrying less about what other people think about you.
And that's true. That's how women are raised as opposed to men. Men are raised not to worry.
Absolutely. And, you know, I grew up with a very strong father and two brothers in my life. And I've said for years, it's interesting that the things that my parents said to me, which were exactly the same as the things that they said to their brothers, were digested differently by me. And it's only over the course of a 20-year working career that I've realized that what they were saying to me was the same. I just need to apply it in the same way. And I think that women are just given filters our whole lives about the way that we're supposed to act and things that we're supposed to do. And as a result of that, we almost shut ourselves off from opportunity. And in this day and age, with the conversations that are having, there's no better time to be ready to have the conversations that we want to have and to do the things that we're ready to do.
What changed your mind?
You know, I've been working for an auction house, for Christie's Auction House, for 20 years. And I think the past 2 years in the world, we've watched as conversations have happened that just have never happened before, and dialogues that maybe we thought internally are coming to the forefront. And, you know, I actually wrote the book. I had sold the proposal right before the Harvey Weinstein scandal hit in October of 2017. And so I think it was just the time. And as I sat down to write it, even so, some of the themes that I'd originally intended to write about in the book were there. The conversations that I was having over the short amount of time that I was writing this book, there were just things that I could not deny needed to be in there. And so some of the things that I had intended to write originally were really expanded upon as I wrote over time.
All right, then, what's in the book?
So the book's great. It's a really fun read for anyone who's interested either in the auction world or in selling. And I get the question all the time about whether or not the book is for men and women. The book is at the core about sales. I've been an auctioneer for 16 years for Christie's Auction House, but I don't take the auctions that you see on TV. So I don't sell Picassos and Monets. I'm a charity auctioneer, which means I get on stage at nonprofit galas and raise money for organizations around the world in order to give them operating budgets or to give them additional money to essentially fulfill their mission. And so in the book, I have about 13 chapters. Each chapter is laid out with stories about how I learned a particular thing. So, for instance, I have a chapter where I talk about, it's entitled You Are What You Negotiate, where I talk about starting at Christie's and having been there for 10 years before I realized that I was actually making a third of what I should have been making at that time. And how I basically went around and figured out exactly what that should have been and then went in and not negotiated a job offer based on that information. And again, I think about this when I told my brothers and my father, and they sort of nodded at me as if, of course, this was something I should have done. But to my girlfriends, this was the most heroic thing they'd ever heard of in their life. So each of these chapters talks about different things and different obstacles that I've faced and how I've overcome them, either through just things that I've learned along the way, or either by being on stage with people who've helped me figure these things out.
Well, but that was something brave, I think, because you just as easily could have gone in and your boss could have said, and don't let the door hit you on the way out, dear.
Right. But I think inherently I also knew that I was in a position of power at that point because I had been at the company for 10 years and I was doing a job that no one else had really done. I'd been promoted to head of events at that point at the age of 26 years old, and I was overseeing 500 events a year. It was 2 weeks before our major events were about to start for the season, and the other two women on my team were almost 8 and 9 years younger than I was. So it really seemed like the time to do it. And I think that that's part of negotiation. It's really understanding what you have that the other person needs and really capitalizing on that. So those stories are told along the way as well.
How do you do an assessment then of what you have? Because I think a lot of people, men and women, don't stop to think about that.
I think communication is key in life. And again, you know, women are inherently good communicators. We're forced to be, frankly, by nature of being mothers or even just in the way that we interact with people. I think there's a lot of conversation that takes place in the female race. And I think that what you need to do is ask people. And I say this again, I think, and I don't think that this is as applicable in men. I don't see it in my brothers. I don't see it in my guy friends as much. You guys are a little bit more open about sharing things. Women, especially in business, I think historically because we've been taught to almost compete against each other for these, you know, four or five positions at the top, we need to communicate and be open about what we have and what we can help others achieve. And I think that this is really the point of the book as well, to make sure that that open communication is something that helps people succeed in life as well. And so if you're looking around thinking, you know, am I ready for that next step, or do I have what it takes, or do they even want me? Have a conversation with the people around you and find out that information before you go in there.
But isn't there a danger you have the conversation and someone else gets the idea to go after the same thing you want?
Well, I mean, that's life, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I worry less about that. And again, it all goes back to power in yourself and really empowering yourself to believe in what you're doing. And so if someone goes in there and negotiates against you for something that you thought was yours, then maybe you weren't strong enough to get it in the first place.
So it's really, you're talking about women supporting each other and asking for what they want.
Exactly. And I think also men as well. I mean, you know, a lot of people have said to me, you know, why would I buy this book? I'm a guy. It's hot pink. And I say to them, you know, every single man that I know who succeeds in life is at the forefront of gender relation issues. They understand what's going on in the workplace, and they're not fighting against it, but they're welcoming the opportunity to get the opposite side of the conversation. And again, as I said, too, in the book, there's a lot about sales. Just having been on stage for so long, for so many years, I've also learned a lot of tricks about how to move things forward and how to move a sale forward. And I think a lot of that is unique to what I've done as a career, because auctioneering is a little bit of a different career, but a lot of those things can be as applicable in my day-to-day life at work when I'm negotiating with one person across a boardroom table.
Well, auctioneering, at least from my perspective, is part performance, isn't it?
Absolutely. I like to say to people, especially charity auctioneering, that I usually walk on stage with a piece of paper that would fill about 3 minutes of notes, and I'm on stage for 45 minutes. So about 42 minutes is me figuring out how to make a crowd pay attention when they'd rather be drinking with the people at their table or, you know, conversing with someone that they see across the room that they haven't seen for a while. So I think inherently in sales, it's really about communication, going back to what I was saying about women in general and why I think that we're good at sales. But it's about communication between two people and understanding the objective of the person across the table. I found so many times in my career and in the role that I now have at Christie's, which is essentially selling brand partnerships for the company, that I'll walk into a meeting with someone and they fire off 40 things that they think that I want without actually asking me what I do or what my objectives are for the meeting. And what I always say to my team is, you need to walk in there. The first thing you should do, the first thing a good salesperson does is listen. Because you need to understand what the person across the table from you wants. And then while they are talking, you are sitting there thinking to yourself how you're going to help them achieve their objectives with what you're selling. And that is what makes a talented salesperson. It's not somebody who, you know, takes a punch list and fires off five things that they're thinking could be good for you. It's about really listening first.
Ever walk into a sales meeting, though, and think, this guy is a yutz and I'm getting out of here?
I mean, of course, haven't we all been there before? But again, I enjoy meeting people, regardless of whether or not I think a sale is ultimately going to work out. And I also have a whole chapter in the book about networking and the importance of networking. I use a phrase that my father used all the time when I was little, network or die, which when I was younger, I didn't know what that meant. But now I really employ it in every element of my life. And network or die essentially means that you are literally networking every single day of your life in every single capacity. I talk to people on planes. I meet people in line for coffee, and those people become part of a network. I'm fastidious about reaching out to people time and time again just to kind of keep them abreast of what's going on. Even in selling this book, I mean, my network, I can't even explain to you how many people I've reached out to that I've known, you know, in the past 20 years just to say hi. I have a book coming out. Would love any advice that you might have about selling a book, or if you would mind just telling one person about it, that would be amazing. But networking is such a key part of business, and people always assume that your network is actually only within the four walls of your company. Your network is your world and the world around you, so it's up to you as to how you optimize it.
It really is all about who you know.
It really is. It really is. At every single level. And I say, too, in business, it's very important when you start working. So I started working in my company when I was 21 years old. And the women and the men who I worked with when I was 21 years old, as we've grown up, are now senior leaders in their companies. Some of them are CEOs. Some of them are global heads of communications and public relations. And all the people who interned for me, you know, when I was in my 20s, are now in very similar jobs. They've really excelled in their careers as well. And those people are also part of my network. It was interesting. So in the book, I have 30 case studies from women who are at the top of their industry, whether that be, you know, a school teacher or someone up to the level of Martha Stewart or Barbara Corcoran. And I just asked each of these women to write a little piece about what they had experienced in their career, and I gave them the chapter heading, No More. So you are what you negotiate. I would love to hear a story about how that happened in your career. And it was incredibly interesting to me to see how they sort of had evolved in their own career and had reached the levels that they had reached over time by maximizing their networks and the communication around them.
And when we get into our next segment, Lydia, I want to ask you about Barbara Corcoran, someone I know a little bit about, and how she did it, because I understood she began as a waitress and built a multi-million dollar real estate empire out of that. So we'll be
incredible,
right? Yes. We'll be back after these messages. Got to run a few commercials. So stay with me, please, Lydia Finette.
Of course.
As we continue here on WIP Sunday, my name's Peter Solomon, the WIP Time, 7:15. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Lydia Finette, author of The Most Powerful Woman in the Room, is you. Lydia, Barbara Corcoran, how do you go from waitress to multi-million dollar real estate empire? Is she offering
so advice? I had asked Barbara to contribute on a chapter about rejection, because I was taking an auction and she had been the MC at the beginning of the auction, and I heard her speak about how she had basically failed out of school, and how she completely and totally, year after year, just thought that she wasn't smart because she wasn't getting the grades that everyone else was getting. But the one thing that she was really good at was that people could give her something to do that they couldn't figure out, and she would figure out a solution for it because of her people skills. And so this became essentially the building blocks for what eventually became her real estate company. And she said that she would just surround herself with people who knew more than she did, like that they were good on the computer, or they were good at the equations that you needed to sell things in real estate. And she would go out and bring the business in and pass it back to them, because that was something that other people weren't good at. So when I asked her to write a piece about rejection, she talked about how she was initially rejected from Shark Tank. And she wrote the producer a letter essentially saying that Every great success she'd ever had been on the heels of rejection. And she asked to fly out to L.A. to audition in person. And he let her do it. And now she's been there, I think, almost 10 years and has invested in over $5 billion worth of deals on Shark Tank. So it's a really great success story about tenacity. And, again, I think going back to power, it's about being able to come back from adversity time and time again and become confident and not let that stop you in your tracks.
If you have a vision, hang on to it.
Exactly. And if you have a vision, let it be your vision. And, you know, I say in the book, too, it's good to roadmap your way to something. And a roadmap, I do it with a pencil and pen, or pencil and paper. I sit down and sketch out the things that I want and that I'd like to accomplish. But I also say that I do it in pencil, because roadmaps sometimes take a different turn, or sometimes they take longer than can be expected. But it's up to you to set your own vision, not someone else. And you're the only person who can execute it. So don't wait around for someone to, you know, discover you and pick you up and make things happen, which I think is what a lot of people think happens to these very successful people. But as you can see in the case studies, especially with Barbara Corcoran, that certainly is not the case. It was about sheer tenacity and will that led her to the success that she's had today.
How about Mariska Hargitay, a wonderful actress in Law and Order Special Victims Unit?
Mariska, so I met Mariska because I took the auction for Joyful Hearts Foundation, which she started after having been on SVU for so many years, because people would come up to her with their stories of sexual abuse and she didn't know how to handle them. So she essentially just started an organization that was really supposed to help heal sexual abuse victims. And then over time, because she has such a voice and such a platform and such an incredible self and sense of self, it really became an advocacy group as well. And, I mean, she lobbies on Capitol Hill to make changes for rape kits. I mean, she has dug deep, and she has done an incredible job with that organization just because of her voice and her vision.
And also an incredible job when you consider some of the difficulties of her earlier childhood.
Yes, exactly. exactly. And I think that this is a theme that I found in the women who have risen to the top, that they have, over the course of their lives, really faced incredible adversity. I mean, some kinds that are hard to even imagine. But over the course of their lives, they've taught themselves to rebound from it and come back stronger every time.
What's the biggest mistake women make in business?
I think we're just afraid of what other people think of us. That's our biggest mistake. We're our own worst enemy and our own worst critic. You know, a lot of times we'll think that someone is thinking something about that that isn't even true, and that person hasn't thought about us all day. And so I say to women all the time, just be less afraid of what other people think and really just be strong in your opinion. You know, and I think you started off the conversation by asking this, like, you know, men are thought of in one way as powerful and women are thought of in a completely different way if they're doing the same thing. And, you know, I truly believe that everything can be done with integrity and grace. I don't think it has to be done with a sort of hard driving approach, which has never been my approach. And yet I've been very successful in my career because I treat everyone kindly. I treat everyone with respect and I ask for the same thing in return. And I get it. I mean, I have had fantastic working relationships almost my entire career, even with people who were very difficult at the beginning, because I really just stayed with them and didn't let them treat me the way that they thought that they could treat me. And I stood firm in my conviction. And that's why I feel like I have been as successful as I have been, both on stage and in the boardroom at work.
Okay, but some people will treat you like a woman, like they're there, dear. You go sit down and rest, maybe take a couple aspirins. Are you feeling ill? Those kinds of things. Male chauvinist things.
Oh, of course. And look, I mean, I probably see more of that in my auctioneering career than I do in my day-to-day job at Christie's. I mean, even as recently as a couple of months ago, I went to take an auction, and a gentleman came up to me before the auction. We were probably around the same age. And he said to me, so I wanted to talk to you about how you're going to start the auction. So I'll just remind your viewers, I've been an auctioneer for 16 years. I take between 70 and 100 auctions a year. So ostensibly, you could say that I've been on thousands of stages since I started. And this gentleman, who was a lawyer in a small town, asked me this question. And I think it would have been very easy for me to say something rude to him, but I always approach these things in the same way. And I said something that my dad often says, with a smile on my face. I said, well, you know, it seems like you might be leading the witness here, so why don't you tell me what you think I should say, and then we'll work backwards from there. And I think he was expecting me to just ask his opinion, or just sort of back up and let him take the show. But by giving him that in, I was sort of reminding him that I actually already knew what I was talking about, and I was happy to hear his opinion, but that I wasn't ultimately going to take it. And hilariously, he started it off by saying, well, you know, I think that because we had this auctioneer last year, and so obviously he only wanted to do right by the organization, but I think the way that he approached it, I could have found very offensive, because this would never have happened to a male colleague. Like, nobody goes up to them to question their auctioneering prowess after taking thousands of auctions over the course of the year. So I just try to never take it to a place that somebody who's trying to be chauvinistic or is trying to put me down, I don't take it to a place where I try to be confrontational. I just sort of smooth it over with a smile and keep moving on. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing I do on stage. I just don't let anybody tell me what they think I should do, because I know what I should do, because I have confidence and conviction in my voice. And that's, again, what I talk about in the book.
But did you ever meet someone in your auctioneering career try to tell you what you wanted to do, they wanted you to do, and you just wanted to smack them in the head?
Of course. But I don't, you know, I often say also, I grew up in the South, catch more bees with honey, right? So what am I going to gain from smacking someone in the mouth? That doesn't really help me at all, because then I feel badly about what I've done. The person who I've punched in the face is going to talk badly about me. And so that gets me nowhere. So I'd rather treat the whole thing in a very respectful manner, and leave that person feeling like they understand that I am going to continue doing my job in the way that I know best. But at the same time, I feel confident in the fact that I've held my integrity and my morals to the standards that I'm happy with and I'm comfortable with. I always say, when I was in events, when I first started in events, the one lesson that I took away from almost 10 years in that job that has served me better than anything else is when things happen in events. So if you imagine, it's a very short timeline where everybody's getting frantic because something's set up, all the top clients from Christie's are coming in, and something goes wrong. And I would watch as the senior leaders would get completely apoplectic and lose their minds over these things, start yelling at people. And then the people below them started yelling at people. And the people below them started yelling at people. And at the end of the day, nothing was getting done because everybody was yelling at someone else, and everyone was out of control. If the person at the top stays calm and in control, firm but calm and in control, then everyone below them continues to execute the way that they are supposed to execute. It's when the person at the top starts to sort of lose it that everybody below them does the same thing, and that's when everything falls apart. And so it's the same thing whenever you're having those conversations. The person who's calm is always, in my opinion, the person who's succeeding. The person who's losing it is always the one who looks a little ridiculous at the end of the day.
Did you ever fail?
Oh, many times. Many, many, many times. And even in the auctioneering world, I mean, sometimes I think that's been the best lesson for me in life because, you know, I get on stage with expectations, especially when I first started taking auctions. I would get on stage with certain expectations and we wouldn't meet them because they didn't have the right bidders in the room, or they didn't have, you know, the microphone didn't work, or there would be some outlying reason that the auction did not go well, or maybe that evening I just wasn't on the way that I needed to be on in order to get the money. And I get off stage, and I mean, that's not just failing. It's not like a sale didn't go well. That's failing in front of a room of 500 people. It could be 1,000 people, and they've all seen what they thought they were going to make that evening, and you weren't able to get there. So that, for me, has been one of the greatest lessons in failure and how to just keep moving forward, because there's certainly times when I really wish the stage would just swallow me whole. But it didn't, and I survived, and I've moved past it, and I've moved on. And I even talk about in the book, I say rejection is a little bit like exercise, because the more you do it, the better you get at it. And the more you get rejected, the easier it becomes. Frankly, even when I was writing the book and I was asking these incredible women to do case studies in the book, a lot of them, because of time constraints, I mean, I was asking people to turn around case studies in sort of 2 to 3 weeks. And some of them just were sort of like, I'm so sorry, there's no way I could do this. Some of them just said no. And I remember the first one that came in, it just felt like, you know, when you get rejected from something, you get that sort of blow to the, you just feel it in your body, you almost feel it. And I remember thinking, well, good, now I know what that feels like, so next time it won't be so bad. And I think that's the thing about rejection. You just have to get used to it, and then you stop fearing it, and then you don't stop, it doesn't stop you from asking, which is the most important part.
So try and always find a positive spin no matter what happens?
Yes, just keeping the glass half full whenever you can. And also being unafraid, as we talked about earlier, to communicate if you feel like something isn't going the way, or you're not being treated the way that you want to be treated. Because I think sometimes there's also people don't realize that their approach is not working for them with you. And I think being very upfront about that is very important as well.
But that's kind of hard to do sometimes, isn't it? You know, excuse me, Lydia, but your approach isn't working on me.
No, but kind of going back to what I said about when I was in the auction and the gentleman came up to me to tell me how to be an auctioneer, you know, I could have shut that down very quickly and been like, I don't need your help. I don't need you to tell me what to do. I've been an auctioneer my whole life. Who are you? That approach doesn't work for me. It may work for some, but it doesn't work for me. So by me just sort of making a little bit of a joke of it and making light of it, it made him understand that he all of a sudden felt like he was in the back foot, and I felt like I was back in a position of being like, why don't you tell me what you'd like for me to think, but I'm still going to do exactly what I'm going to do because I've been doing this for a long time and I know what I'm doing.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and we're talking with success extraordinaire Lydia Fenette, author of the new book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You, Command an Audience and Sell Your Way to Success. Good advice, whether you're a woman or a man, so it's worth listening to. And that will do when we come back after these messages here on 94 WIP, WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. It's WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning into the home stretch, Miss Lydia Fenette, She's author of the new book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You. Command an audience and sell your way to success. Lydia, why did you decide to write the book? I mean, you go into any bookstore, you're going to find a lot of books like yours.
That's true. I think that for more than any other reason, I just don't feel like there has ever been a time for women to have confidence and conviction in their voice like there is right now. And I have a unique perspective, having spent so much time on stage, just learning about the human interactions between women and men and women on stage selling. And I just felt like it was time to write something based on what I'd seen. And frankly, there was no better time than today. So although I think there are a lot of women's books right now that are coming out, there are very few books about women in selling. And that was the point of distinction for me.
You talk about selling something, whether it's an auction item or whatever. But this is also the season to be selling yourself if you're a politician. You think it works equally well when you're the commodity?
I think so, too. I think it just goes back to what I talked about at the beginning of this segment, and having power and conviction in yourself. Because everybody, I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it must be to be a politician with people firing things at you left, right, and center. And I think the only way that you get through that in a way that seems real to people who are watching you every single day and watching your every step is to be truthful to who you are. So a lot of that is finding out who you are really and figuring out what about that is going to be appealing to those outside of you, and then being really strong about ensuring that every single person who interacts with you is seeing the same thing and they're not looking at you thinking that you're flipping and flopping back and forth.
How do you want people to use the book?
I want them to use it as a roadmap and as a guide. You know, I've had a couple of people read the book, and it's interesting because when I wrote it, I was writing it really, I thought, for women in their 20s and 30s. And I remember my editor saying to me very early on, she was like, you know, you work for Christie's, which is just this incredible premier brand, but that's not going to resonate with everyone. This book is really for every woman. So what is the thread that pulls through that makes it relevant to every woman? And so, as I said earlier, I grew up in a small town in Louisiana, and you know, my parents did not collect art. We were not people who went to Christie's to collect art. Frankly, I didn't even know that the auction world existed until I was in college and sort of read an article in a magazine about it. And so I really wanted to dig deep into my past and explain how all of these things that I grew up with and all of these things I've seen in the past 20 years of my career have really helped me articulate this vision. And so I hope people will use this book as a sort of guidebook for things that they should and shouldn't do and things that they should just remember along the way. It's interesting, as I was saying, there have been a couple of people who've read it, and they're women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and all of them come back to me and say, this is my story. You don't understand. Like, I was the lonely person who'd moved somewhere after college and didn't know how to start a career, or didn't even realize that I was in a career until I was 10 years into it. And it seemed too late at that point to start negotiating for what I deserved. Or, you know, a woman my age who's like, I've been through so many of these things, and this just felt like I was rereading my own life. And then even I did a book reading for women, mostly in their sort of 50s and 60s, and I was a little nervous because I didn't really realize if it would resonate with them in the same way, because I think there have been a lot of shifts in women's issues, especially in the past couple of years. And I was reading the chapter entitled You Are What You Negotiate, and I was very emotional when I was reading it because it was a very emotional time for me. And I looked up at one point, and there was a woman who was crying. And when I sat back down at the table, she said to me, I felt that frustration so many times and I never voiced it and I wish I had. And that to me was such an incredible moment because I realized I think this book is not only going to help women in their 20s and frankly even high schoolers and younger women as they grow up be more aware of the things that we weren't aware of, but I think it'll help open the channels for people who've been through it to talk about it with people who are younger, because I see myself now as the voice of the next generation who has been through work and wants to help the women who are younger really succeed in their jobs and not stumble into the same pitfalls that we fell into. And so that's what this book is. I look at it as a guidebook or a roadmap. And I hope people really enjoy it.
Makes me wonder what a different world it would be if our mothers and our grandmothers had this book.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, I have these conversations with my mother, who's an amazing mom. I mean, she raised four children and actually got her real estate license last year at the age of, well, I can't tell you her age online, but I mean, on air. But you know, my father and my brothers and I, my whole life have said to her, she had a company that she started after we went to college where she sold handbags. And she used to say to me all the time, I can't sell them because I feel like when people are rejecting me, when they're rejecting the purse, they're rejecting me. And no matter how many times we would say to her, it's no, rejection is not emotional. You have to take the emotion out of it. But I think as women, that's what we do time and time again. We get very emotional about getting rejected. We worry that if we don't get a raise, it's because people don't like us. When in fact, and I say this to my team all the time, rejection is not emotional. You have to separate these two things. You have to understand if the answer is no, it may be because I don't have the budget. Or it may be, frankly, that you're not doing a good enough job. But I'll tell you that too. You have to get used to hearing these things, and you have to realize it's okay to be rejected. And so I sometimes wish that, you know, I'd given this to my mom many, many years ago because I feel like she would have loved to read it. And I feel like she's come to this awareness now. I mean, you should see her out there selling houses. She's having a ball.
And I didn't realize you grew up down south in Louisiana, where you were probably where you were probably raised to be a good little Southern lady, weren't you?
Yes, absolutely. That was it. But, you know, my mother is actually British, and my father traveled extensively, and I think that they weren't quite as Southern as we could have been, certainly. I definitely saw that as a trait that a lot of my friends, it was never that the girls and the boys were equal, which was definitely how my parents raised us. If the boys were going to play soccer, the girls were going to play soccer. If we wanted to try a new sport, you know, we were all allowed to try it together. And so I think a lot of the reason in life I've been successful is because I was raised in this sort of rock tumbler of older brother, younger sister, all sort of competing for everything all the time, and parents who were willing to let us sort of hash it out on our own, which I think is a great lesson in life for really just equal opportunity.
But I would imagine some of the young ladies you grew up with were raised to be a good lady. I read in a book once Southern women described as daddy's girls.
Yeah, and I think that there's, you know, I think you find that, frankly, in any culture, certainly in the Southern culture. And, you know, I gave a talk at a conference down in Sea Island, Georgia, a couple of months ago, and in the conversations that I was having down in the South with women were more about, well, you know, someone said it to me, you know, your husband must be very understanding, you know, that you're working. And that was just not something that I hear in New York a lot. It's definitely a very different way of looking at it. And I said, well, I don't think that my husband's necessarily understanding. I mean, we both work because we want to live a certain life, and it takes two incomes to do that. And I also, by the way, am very fulfilled by my job, and I'm very proud to go to work every day. And I love that my daughter tells people that her mommy's an author and an auctioneer and brings a gavel that I've given her to school every once in a while. I mean, I think that's great, and I want to be a role model for my daughter. So I try to, again, you have to understand that there are cultural sensitivities. And I think that having grown up with a mother who was British, who often said that to me, that she would say, it's not bad or good, it's just different. And so I try to look at the conversations that I'm having across the country around this book and be sensitive to the fact that people are seeing things and hearing things differently, but that my message is the same wherever I'm telling it.
And it's important to point out, you know, he may not be happy you're working, but he's sure happy every time he sees your paycheck.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I say that too. It's, you know, a lot of people sort of said to me, like, how could you write this book? You have three kids, you have, you're an auctioneer, you have a full-time job. And I said, yeah, but I wanted to write this book. And so I found the time. I put my kids to bed every single night, and I'd go back into my room and write for an hour to an hour and a half. And eventually the book was done, and it was done in 3 months. I mean, it was probably one of the most stressful periods of my entire life. I mean, my youngest at that point was barely a year old. But I think if you want to do something and you put your mind to it, you can do it. And that's a great life lesson. And also going back to what I said at the beginning, you're the only person who can do it. I think for a long time I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to have this great goal that I'm going to reach, but how can you reach a goal if you're not the person doing it? It doesn't work like that. So you have to put in the work.
Is there a next book coming?
So I hope the next book will be The Most Powerful Girl in the Room is You, which would be a young adult adaptation. But yes, I have many more books in me. I have plenty to say.
Have you put a copy of The Most Powerful Woman away for your daughter?
I have, yes. I have two daughters, actually, and they both have one, and one for my son, too. You know, I think it's important that he reads it as well, and that he understands, and he can be supportive in his life for his sisters, because, you know, I think having a strong father and two brothers has been an incredible gift to me in my life, and they've been there throughout it all, you know, giving me counterpoints to everything that I say out loud, which I think is, again, it's important. It makes you strong and it makes you powerful.
Absolutely. And a gift to your son for his future partner in life as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'd like to say thank you to my guest this morning, Lydia Finette. Her new book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. Guys, something for you to look at, something for your spouse to look at, something for your daughters to look at. Check it out. Thank you, Barbara. Lydia, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I'll pretend I'm Barbara Corcoran tonight. Okay. Peter, thank you so much for
You're
having
welcome.
Me.
Okay. My pleasure. Bye. And you've been listening to another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions. I know I'll be listening. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Tidman Solomon, associate producer, and my dear wife. I couldn't do the show without either one of you. Nothing left to say, but enjoy the sun while it's out. Take an umbrella just in case. See you soon.